Hello, Vijay. Good evening.
Good evening, Vijay.
Hello.
Hey,
good midday.
Hello, guys. It's
good evening.
Hello, Vijay.
Great to be with you.
Evening.
We're so glad you're here. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I have to say, we're honored you're here.
Oh, I appreciate that. I've never been to the Netherlands, but I've been a fan of your country since I was a little kid. I used to be a huge fan of your soccer team in 1990. I still remember the players, Marco van Basten and Ruud Gullit and Frank Rijkaard. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, we're still good. The European Championships are going on right now. So,
awesome.
We're fighting for the quarterfinals next Sunday. So,
good luck.
Thank you. Do you want me to give a little intro about what you get yourself into? We're the Bitcoin Netherlands Clubhouse Room, and we started this a few months ago. And we talked about Bitcoin almost daily, and so we got an audience by talking about Bitcoin. And what makes us interesting for people to listen is we have a lot of different angles on Bitcoin. We have the A specialists, we have maximalists, we have day traders and all that. And since a few weeks, we try to get guests in the room that can deliver value to the Dutch Bitcoin community.
Yeah, good explanation, man. It's, like you said, a very diverse group of people. So we'd like to have a big bullish Bitcoin guest for our little show here. So welcome.
Thank you. I'd love to hear more about the community in the Netherlands and how people are receiving Bitcoin in your country and what people think. So I'm excited to hear about that as well.
Yes. Well, our friend Roy has done an investigation about that. Maybe he can talk a little bit about that later. But can you introduce yourself a little bit, Vijay?
So I'm Vijay Boyapati. I am originally from Australia. You might hear that a little bit in my accent. I live in the United States now. I'm a computer scientist by training. I came to the US to do a PhD in computer science, but I didn't end up doing the PhD. I took a job at a little startup that you might have heard of. It's called Google. It was a small company when I joined. This was back in early 2002. I left Google to do some campaigning in the 2008 presidential elections. I went to campaign for Ron Paul, who's this kind of freedom-loving candidate, anti-war, pro-sound money and wanted to audit the Federal Reserve in the United States. I became pretty disillusioned with the political process after, you know, taking part in that presidential election and realized there were much bigger forces that decided the outcome of elections. And so I was, you know, fairly cynical about politics and pessimistic about the future. And then I came across Bitcoin in 2011, and I was really excited about it when I started looking into what it was and, you know, what effect it might have on the world. And, you know, since 2011, I've just been so fascinated with the economics of Bitcoin and just trying to understand what I think is a really foundational question. How does this thing that was created out of thin air, how does it have any value at all? Why does it have a market price? And I've been thinking about that question for a long time. And I wrote an essay about it through 2017, and it was published in early 2018, called The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, where I sort of lay out an economic framework for understanding why Bitcoin has value. Why is it valuable? And I recently published that a longer version of the essay, which sort of goes into even more depth just a few months ago. I published it as a book in English and launched it on Kickstarter, and that's done pretty well. The Kickstarter went pretty well. So that's a little bit about me and how I got interested in Bitcoin and my background. So I'm happy to talk to you guys about anything you want.
Yeah, thank you, thank you. That was a nice introduction. Yeah, we talked a bit about what we were going to discuss in this room, and I think everyone is dying to hear about Miami. So, can you take us back to your weekend in Miami and what happened there? You launched your book there. You hosted the, I think you hosted the conversation also on stage.
So Miami, wow. I've never been to Miami before, and I'm someone who's not very used to hot weather. I live in Seattle. It's quite cold in Seattle. We're pretty far north. And I went to Miami, and it was hotter than I expected. And I spent a lot of time outside in a tent signing books for people. Probably, gosh, for the two days I was signing books, I was outside for I think 4 hours each time or 5 hours, just nonstop. And I remember, this is kind of an embarrassing anecdote, but I drank 6 bottles of water on the first day, and I didn't need to go to the bathroom once. That's how hot it was in that tent. It was just sweltering. There was so many people in there, but it was so exciting. There were so many people from around the world who were excited about Bitcoin, and the conference was massive. There was like, I think, 12,000 people there. So it was so exciting for me to see that, Bitcoin has grown this much. The last conference I'd gone to, the last Bitcoin conference I'd gone to, was a long time ago in 2013. And there's this funny video of Andreas Antonopoulos giving a presentation about Bitcoin in front of an empty room. There was like no one there. And it kind of, it to me, it showed how much Bitcoin has grown. Just in the flesh, you could see it just by the number of people there. So that was really cool for me. I got to do a panel with some of my favorite Bitcoiners, Saifedean, Dan Held, and Parker Lewis. I got to moderate a panel, and it actually was the first panel at the conference on the first day. So that was really exciting and cool for me. And the topic of the panel was picturing a hyper Bitcoinized world. That is, what would the world look like under a Bitcoin standard? What things would change? And how would our future be different today under kind of a fiat standard? So that was really cool. I got to meet a hero of mine. I mentioned I left Google to campaign for Ron Paul. Ron Paul was backstage, and he gave the talk literally right before my talk. And I got to hang out with him backstage, and I hadn't seen him for almost a decade. And we were joking about how he was worried about me quitting my job at Google to go campaign for him, and whether that was a good idea. And we laughed about that. If you guys have any specific questions, I'm happy to answer them. But that's kind of what happened for me at Miami.
Yeah, so I guess Ron Paul was the person that impressed you the most on the Bitcoin conference.
No, I mean, there's so many people, and I threw a party before the conference, the night before the conference, for some of my favorite Bitcoiners, and I hosted about 40 people, and I provided dinner and drinks and cocktails, and it was a beautiful night in Miami. It was like the sun was setting, and we're all just hanging out. People like Safe and Senator, there's a US Senator, Senator Lummis, who came, just Alan Farrington, and Dan came, Dan Held, just tons of like all the really prominent Bitcoiners who I feel like I've learned a lot from, and who an inspiration to me. They were all there, and it was a really cool evening getting to hang out with them. So I'm a fan of everyone in the space, and everyone's doing kind of different things to work on Bitcoin or to help Bitcoin. Like Caitlin Long, for instance, is trying to get friendly regulations for Bitcoin in the state that she lives in Wyoming. She was there. So yeah, it was a great gathering, and I'm impressed with everyone I saw. I just feel like people are so passionate about Bitcoin, and they're working on their own specific thing. So another example is, I met a guy, his name is Carlino. He's started an exchange in Guatemala, and it's going really well. It's growing really quickly, and I felt like I met a bunch of people like that who are starting businesses to help people get into Bitcoin, and just in different countries around the world. I had no idea about any of this, and it was a chance for me to learn about that kind of stuff and speak to people like that. So I'm super, super excited about, what's happening in the Bitcoin space right now. I know the price is down and that can be a little bit depressing, but I feel like the fundamentals of what's actually being built and what people are doing is just awesome. It's so cool.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit more about the FUD later. Did the Miami conference give you some new insights that you didn't have before you attended that?
I guess just seeing some of the businesses that are being built in places that I didn't know about and that are growing and are really successful. I met the founder of an exchange in the Middle East, and their business is growing very, very rapidly. So this tells me that adoption, global adoption, is going really well. I know that Bitcoin has a lot of awareness in the United States and Western Europe, but I think it's not quite as there isn't as much awareness in some of the other parts of the world. So I'm just it was I think one thing I learned is that there are a lot of people in different parts of the world trying to start up that, basic infrastructure that you need to get people into Bitcoin, like the exchanges and the wallet infrastructure and all of that kind of stuff. To see that that's starting all over the place. I wasn't, really familiar with that, and I learned, I feel like I learned a lot about that.
Yes, and speaking of adoption, the main thing in Miami was, of course, the El Salvador launch. Let's say like this, you know what I mean? They will get Bitcoin as an as a payment.
Legal tender.
Yeah, as a legal tender. Thank you. So how do you look at that? What's your opinion about that?
And today, Panama, by the way.
Yeah, I think that it really surprised me, and I think it's a stunning development. I honestly didn't expect something like that to happen for at least a few more cycles. Bitcoin has gone through these cycles where the price will go up a lot, and then it'll crash and it'll go up a lot. It's had like four of them now, I think, four or five. And I didn't expect something like this to happen for another few more cycles. I think it's an incredible development. Because it lowers the friction of people using Bitcoin. I don't know what the rules or the laws are in the Netherlands, but in the US, if you buy Bitcoin and then you use it to transact or to buy something with it, if the value of that Bitcoin has gone up, you have to pay tax on the appreciation when you use it transactionally. And that's a really huge friction on you transactional usage for Bitcoin, which really limits that usage. People don't want to use it that way because they don't want to pay tax every time they pay for something. So they use it mainly as a savings vehicle. What they've done in El Salvador is they've made it completely tax-free. It's like it's money. They're treating it as money. And what that means is that I think there's going to be much more transactional usage in El Salvador, and I think it's really helpful for people in the rural parts of El Salvador where they don't have a lot of banking infrastructure. They can use Bitcoin now and they can use it to accept payments and they can use it to transact with each other. Because the thing is, the banking infrastructure for Bitcoin exists on the internet. All you need is an internet connection to have financial infrastructure to be able to keep, your savings or to lend out your savings and earn interest on it. All of that exists online. So they now have access to that infrastructure, even if they don't have banking infrastructure in the parts of El Salvador that they live in. And I think it's really cool because I think, people in El Salvador are going to start not just transacting in Bitcoin. I think because there's such a big push from the president of the country, people are going to start considering saving in Bitcoin. And I think over the period of a few years, they're going to see those savings appreciate because, over a long enough time horizon, I think if you hold Bitcoin for more than, I think 2.5 years, there's never been a period when Bitcoin has lost value if you have just a long enough time horizon, about 2.5 years. So I think countries in Latin America are gonna look at El Salvador and say, wow, they're starting to do really well, and the people are starting to enrich themselves because they're holding savings in something that's appreciating. So I think it's the first domino that's gonna it's going to encourage other countries to look at this as something that they should do too. So I'm super excited about that, as well as a development that sort of was announced in Miami.
Yeah,
And I
Vijay.
do. Oh, sorry. Right.
Oh yeah, sorry. Hey, Vijay, Khan here. So I was thinking about that because Jack Mullis, he also said on stage, right, that we were not ready for the news that which was going to come. Which is really funny, and it was a huge news for all Bitcoiners worldwide. But what game theory do you see happening between countries on this basis of El Salvador?
Yeah, I thought my suspicion was that the first countries that would adopt Bitcoin would be like small kind of dictatorships, because getting something like this to happen requires, a lot of political capital, and in a democracy, and democracies tend to move quite slowly. I think this might be a counterexample to my thinking on this, because I mean, in this example, Bukele, the president, is very, very popular in his country, and so he had enough political capital, even though it's a democracy, to get this through. I had thought that it would be countries like North Korea, unfortunately, that would be the first to start adding Bitcoin to their reserves, or Venezuela, because they're sort of cut off from the international global financial system. By the United States. And there's this story in Venezuela that the president Maduro tried to repatriate the gold from the Bank of England, the gold owned by the country of Venezuela, and the Bank of England said no. They said no because they didn't like him as a dictator. But that's a scary thing as a nation state, right? You have your savings held by another country and you can't get them back. Bitcoin is really a solution to that, because custodying Bitcoin, keeping it yourself, is fairly cheap and easy, and it's very easy to transmit as well. So if you're one of these pariah countries who is cut off from the international system, then it really makes sense to have some savings in Bitcoin. So I had imagined that it would be those kind of countries. I think it's really cool that it isn't one of those countries, and it turns out that it's a small Latin American country that's trying to pull itself out of poverty. I think that's awesome. And I think the game theory here is it may have shifted a little bit from what I was thinking, where it would be like pariah nations adopting Bitcoin so that they had something valuable that couldn't easily be taken by the US. Adopting it might change to the sort of poorer nations. Maybe Latin America is going to pioneer this, and they're going to see El Salvador. They're going to look at it as an example and say, well, over the period of 5 years, El Salvador has really improved its position financially and the position of its people. So we should really consider this. And I think over a time horizon of about 5 years, this is going to have a big impact on poorer nations that are going to look at this country as an example. That's kind of my guess of how this will play out over the next 5 years or so.
Yeah, massive man, and a huge shout out to Bitcoin Beach for being there so long before it became popular there. That's a lot of respect needs to
Yeah,
be given.
absolutely. I followed them this week. I do this thing on Twitter where I follow one account per week, because I just want to highlight an account that people should, it's worth following, and I followed them this week to highlight the amazing work that they have done starting this in a village in El Salvador, and showing that it's possible that you can use Bitcoin as money in a small location. And they obviously inspired the leaders of that country enough that they said, well, let's do this in the whole country. So I think it's an amazing achievement that they have, and the people who are working on that should be very proud of themselves.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, right. Hey, so Vijay, what is the why is Bitcoin needed in the world? I mean, it depends on particular places, right? I mean, if you're talking about the rich, wealthy Western world, you need Bitcoin for something else, I guess. And if you're talking about third world countries, you need Bitcoin for one other purposes, right? So, what does Bitcoin fix in the Western world, according to
Yeah,
you?
that's a great question. You know, I think the desire for people to keep their savings, the fruit of their labor. You know, you work hard at your job or you have a business, and you produce savings over time, or the profits from your business, and the desire to keep those savings safe and to be able to own them and take them where you want. I think that's a universal value that's been, you know, humans have had since the dawn of civilization. And I think, you know, for people in poorer countries, you don't really need to explain to them why it's good to have, you know, sound money. If you talk to someone in Argentina, the country that's gone through several hyperinflations, they understand this very clearly. And, you know, to give an example, I have a friend who told me a story when he was a child in Argentina. If you go to the grocery store, there would be someone who would be putting prices on the goods in the grocery store, moving down the aisles and putting prices on. And when they got to the end of the grocery store, they'd just go back to the start and start updating the prices. They had to update the prices so quickly because the money was losing value that quickly that if they didn't update it, they would be losing real value when they're selling to people. Now that's not as obvious to people in the West right now, but you know, I think we live in unprecedented times. The central banks of the world are running policies that have no precedent in history at all, like government bonds you know, across many countries of the world trading near zero or even negative, and holding interest rates near zero. This is really an unprecedented monetary policy. I do not believe this is going to end well, and I think it's going to lead to the financial system unraveling. And I think people are going to be looking for a lifeboat. They're going to be looking for a way to keep their savings safe. They can't be debased, and I think they're going to be looking for something like Bitcoin. You know, historically people would have looked to something like gold, but gold has several disadvantages to Bitcoin. Its physicality is actually a big disadvantage because it's not easy to transmit, so you can't send it across the world. And we live in a digital world now where people want to trade with each other and send value across borders. And its physicality also makes it, you know, difficult to store. It's risky to store it, so you need to find an institution to hold it for you. And that causes it has centralizing tendencies where, you know, historically gold was held at banks, and it made it much more vulnerable to state confiscation. And that's, you know, at least what happened in the United States when they ended the gold standard. They basically took everyone's gold in 1933. They said all of the gold now is ours, is the gold of the US government, and in exchange we're going to give you these paper certificates, the dollars. But you're not allowed to redeem them anymore. Before that, you could always redeem your dollars and go to the bank and say, you know, I want the gold. But they cut off that convertibility and they took everyone's gold. So gold has some disadvantages that mean I think that people will prefer Bitcoin. When I believe that the financial system begins to unravel, because I don't see how this policy of just massive inflation and encouragement of massive amounts of debt can end well.
Yeah.
So you're right. I agree with you that people in the West are kind of complacent. Most people in the West haven't experienced what it's like to be in at least in their lifetime, go through a monetary catastrophe. You know, I know in Europe, for instance, the Germans in the 20s went through one, but that's a long time ago, and people who are living today probably haven't experienced anything like that. But I don't think that means it will never happen. And we're in uncharted waters. We don't know what's going to happen with the global financial system. I don't think it'll end well. And I think that will be when it starts to unravel, that will be like a critical event for Bitcoin's monetization. Like everything we've seen so far in Bitcoin's adoption, will be accelerated much, much faster in a sort of global catastrophe where it becomes clear that the monetary system is very fragile and it can't. I think it won't be able to be rescued. Like the thing that happened in 2008, the global financial crisis, I think is quite small. Well, what they did was kind of try and patch it up and keep it going, and they've just made the bubble even bigger. The bubble in government bonds is just so big that people are literally paying the government money to hold their money. So, government bonds are negative yielding in parts of Europe. So I think at the point where it unravels, that is going to be Bitcoin's moment to shine, and people in the West will wake up, and they'll realize that they're not different. Their governments aren't necessarily different to the Argentinian government. The mismanagement is going to come to the West, and people are going to have to figure out a way to keep their savings safe. And I think the best way to keep your savings safe is in Bitcoin.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any time frame for this whole unravelment process, you know? Because
I,
I think the same way, but I think they can postpone it for for a long time since they have a lot of power.
yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that this can continue to go on because I already think we're in uncharted waters. The monetary policy that's being pursued by central banks is so out of the historical norm. I would be very, very surprised if this can go on for more than, 5 or 10 years at the maximum. So I've always been, bullish on Bitcoin, but my bullishness has extended over kind of longer time frames. I'm extremely bullish on Bitcoin over the time frame of a decade, and I've sort of viewed there's an inevitability of it becoming the world's monetary base in the way that gold was the monetary base in the 19th century. But I view that as something that could happen over, say, 20 years to 50 years. So I think it's a really important development that will really help my children and my grandchildren.
Hey Vijay, on the topic of kicking the can down the road, so Japan has been in this stagflationary economic phase for forever now. I guess our generation, the millennials, have only seen the stagflation since the start of World War II. The stagflation phase of Japan started. What if I say that? So, looking at the world monetary system, it's all connected to the US dollar. And as long as the US dollar stays in the positive interest space, the world can just move on and it can just keep dragging their feet. But what if the US goes into that stagnation phase like Japan has? What effect does that have on the rest of the world? What do
Yeah, I mean that's certainly a possibility, and you're right. Japan has been in this kind of phase where they've had very, very low interest rates for a very long time, and they've had very low growth as well. I can't imagine the U.S. is a country that could just politically handle going through an extended period of low growth. It's a country which needs growth, that thrives on growth. And it's I almost view it as like a nation that would break up under that kind of scenario, because it's not like Japan where you have a pretty uniform population, sort of ethnically and politically. The US is very diverse, and right now the United States is incredibly polarized politically, and I can't imagine being in a period of extended multi-decade stagnation that the institutions in the US could hold up. I'm already very concerned about that, about the US in that sense right now. Both sides of the political spectrum are trying to destroy each other, and the policies that they're trying to pursue would have been unthinkable even a decade ago. I mean, they're talking about things like packing the Supreme Court in the United States. This is very venerable institution in the US, the US Supreme Court. And they're talking about politicizing it because they don't like that the other side has control in a sense. So I'm worried about the political future of the US, and I don't know what will happen. I just can't see the US handling long periods of stagnation without something really badly breaking politically. I don't mean to be too pessimistic about that. I know that sounds very pessimistic, but it does right now, at least, it feels quite grim looking at the politics in the US.
Yeah, I guess those elites, the people in power, they're introducing they will be introducing CBDCs, the central bank digital currencies, to fix, I guess, some of the issues that we have right now. What are your insights into that? Do you have you looked into it?
Yeah, I mean, CBDCs are the central bank digital currencies. I mean, I think they're just a really scary development. The country which is pioneering this is China, and China is a country. Why are they pioneering it in China? Why are they so excited about these digital currencies? It's because they're almost surveillance technologies. They're a way that you can track everyone's purchasing history, and China right now is like a panopticon. It's like you're constantly surveilled. You walk outside and they have cameras everywhere, and they use facial recognition and artificial intelligence to know where you are at all times. And then with these CBDCs, they'll be able to track everything you buy. And if they want to stimulate the economy, the way they describe stimulating the economy is just creating money, they can just add more of these tokens to your wallet, and if they want to pull back the economy, they can take them out. So they'll have full control over, your financial life. I think that's a really worrying development, and the US hasn't pursued this very much. They're thinking about it a little bit, but I would be very worried about these currencies being created. Honestly, there's been, I think this is probably even more so in Europe, but there's been a war on cash in a lot of countries in the Western world, and that they really don't want people to use cash because cash affords people an amount of privacy and ability to sort of live outside the world of surveillance. And I think a move towards these central bank digital currencies is going to put too much power in the hand of these governments to watch everything that people do. So I'm worried about this development. I'm hopeful that because we have Bitcoin, we have an escape hatch that we can always keep our savings in Bitcoin. And it's very hard to shut Bitcoin down because it's so decentralized and it exists on the internet. And no matter where you are, as long as you have an internet connection, you can keep your savings outside of these government networks that they're trying to create.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, they've obviously seen that there's some, that there's some real innovation that was created by Bitcoin and the use of blockchains, and they want to piggyback on that, and they want to use it for their own purposes. So we'll see how that goes. Certainly, we should be keeping a close eye on China and what they're doing there, and whether that's a warning for people in the West about what could happen if a nation state starts using these. We should be very wary, I think.
Yeah, and now in China they try to ban Bitcoin, but it's quite interesting when they find out they cannot ban it. So I want to see what's going on after that. I think the whole world will adopt it. What do you think about that? If they find out they cannot ban Bitcoin, Vijay, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so this ban that they've had so many bans in China, all different kinds of bans. I mean, some of the bans that they've had were just shutting down the exchanges where people would buy Bitcoin, but those are fairly easy to reverse because it's just sort of, you can move your servers to another country. and then restart it, and the service is available on the internet. But what they did with mining, I think, is a much bigger deal, because they are shutting down physical infrastructure that the miners have to move, and it's very costly to move it, and they have to find other jurisdictions around the world that will be friendly toward them and let them run their mining and use electricity in those jurisdictions. So what I think is, this is a ban which will have long-lasting effects, because miners are going to be much more wary about running their business in China from now on. They're going to be looking for places around the world where they can trust that there's some stability, political stability, that their policies aren't going to be just changed on a whim by some Communist Party bureaucrat saying you can't do this anymore. So, I think this is actually, ironically, very, very positive for Bitcoin in the long term. And if you were looking from outer space on the world and trying to understand Bitcoin, you would almost think China was trying to help Bitcoin, because they provided cheap electricity to secure the Bitcoin network for a decade. And then all of a sudden, when the mining concentration was so high and it was so concentrated in China said, no, all of you have to get out, and you have to go decentralize around the world and find other countries to be in, which is great for the Bitcoin network, for the resilience of the Bitcoin network. To have mining spread out across the world is so much healthier. So if you were looking at it as an alien looking down, you'd say, wow, the Chinese government really loves Bitcoin. They're trying to help Bitcoin. Now, obviously, that's not what's happening. They have other motivations for why they're doing this. But I think long term, this is really going to be great. It's going to be much harder to attack the Bitcoin network with mining spread out, especially spread out in countries which are have a lot less authoritarian power to shut things down. Having mining, some of the mining moved to Texas, to move to Iceland, to move to El Salvador. That's a great thing, I think, for the resilience of the network.
Okay, thank you. I have another question. We were earlier talking about like long-term adoption, like about hyper-Bitcoinization. Something we often get into, like discussions we often get into here on Clubhouse or on Twitter, is that many people, especially the current Keynesian economists, they say that an economy cannot grow sufficiently when you have a deflationary currency. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a misconception. I mean, if you look at the pockets of the economy that are so productive that you see deflation, those are the most productive parts of the economy. It's technology. So one of the arguments against deflation is that if the money is appreciating in purchasing power, people just don't want to spend it. They're not going to spend it, and that's going to crash the economy, because no one's going to spend. But that's actually a really, I think, poor fallacy that we understand when we look at these pockets of the economy isn't true. It's like the cost of an iPhone goes down every year, right? Or the quality of the iPhone you can get for the same money goes up. So does that mean you're never going to buy an iPhone? Does it mean that you all have like phones from 2005, because you know that the cost of the phone is going to go down, so you're just going to hold your money and never get that phone? That's not true. What when people see enough value that they can get from spending their money, even if they could get more later in the future, they'll spend it now, because that value is really important to them now. So I think this is a big fallacy, and I think if you look at the Austrian school, there's a lot of literature that goes over this, and the big debate about the Great Depression being really bad because of deflation, I think has really been debunked, and I think it's worth looking into some of that literature. There's a great book by Murray Rothbard called The Great Depression, where he tackles this issue. And so my view is that a world in which deflation, the monetary system is deflationary, is actually good, because it means that people who want to save don't need to feel fear that their savings are going to you know, dissipate over time. So when they keep their assets or some of their savings in Bitcoin, they know that the value should appreciate over time. When Bitcoin becomes global money, it's not going to appreciate as fast as it is now. It'll probably appreciate in purchasing power by 3 to 5% per year, or whatever the global productivity is. So people will feel more confident of keeping their savings in money. Right now, what you have is that people feel so afraid of keeping their savings in cash because that cash will lose value, that they're forced out of cash. And that makes regular people think about, like, how do I invest my money so that I don't lose it through inflation? And that kind of encourages gambling. In the US, there's this website called Robinhood, which lets, you know, average people invest in stocks, even if they don't have much money. And it's become like this day trading vehicle that people in regular professions, doctors and carpenters and, you know, accountants and whatever, they're putting their savings into these websites and they're day trading on stocks like GameStop, which is a stock of this gaming company in the US, which went, you know, crazy. The price went absolutely crazy and then it crashed and went up and down. And I think that's really unhealthy for the economy when people are not focusing on their craft, focusing on bettering themselves, like making themselves a better doctor by going to conferences and so on and so forth, and they're wasting their time gambling. That's really bad for the division of labor. It's bad for society. And I think when we live with inflationary currencies, that's the tendency, that people are trying to figure out a way that their precious savings that they worked so hard to accumulate, how do I keep them safe? What do I do? Should I put them in stocks or bonds? And, you know, most people shouldn't be making those decisions and they shouldn't be day trading. It would be great if you could keep your savings just in money. And if you really had some insight, if you had some special knowledge, then you would go out and invest. That would be great, versus being forced to invest, just because if you don't invest, your savings are going to melt away over time.
Yeah, imagine people saving money for their kids until they get 18 or so. The inflation on that might be disastrous for those children.
Right, absolutely. And so people, when they invest for their kids, they have to figure out. I mean, most people don't have much knowledge of the stock market. Their knowledge is about their job, what their profession or what they do. And that's the way it should be. We should focus on what we're, you know, our comparative advantage and what we're talented at. And that's good for the division of labor. It's good for society. It's good for the economy. And when people have to focus on these other things like investing in stocks or bonds and they have to, you know, day trade, that's just not really good. And I think that's the big disadvantage that's not really accounted for by people who think we need an inflationary currency.
And I think the same goes for real estate, for example. People should only be investing in or buying real estate if they need a roof over their head, if they need a place to live or to have an office, and not as a way to store their value and protect their hard-earned labor from
absolutely
from inflation.
Right. That's a really good example, because historically houses weren't viewed as an investment vehicle. They were viewed as almost like a liability. You buy it because you need to live in it and you have the utility of it. But over the last 30 or 40 years, that view has transformed in a lot of Western countries. And now the house is this savings vehicle. People put money in their house because they're afraid if they don't put it somewhere else, it's going to lose value. And so you get these gigantic bubbles, like the housing bubble that burst in 2007 and 2008, just because it becomes a vehicle for speculation. And you keep getting these vehicles for speculation. Why? You get them because people are afraid for their savings and they're looking to put it in something. And so you get these periodic bubbles. And I think that's really unhealthy. And I think it's going to unwind. I think, you know, the next collapse that happens is going to be even worse than the 2008 financial crisis.
Yes, interesting, VJ. Let me reset the room real quick. welcome to Bitcoin Netherlands. We have VJ Boyapati in the room. We're halfway through, so we have 45 minutes left. Please click on the greenhouse to follow us. You can also join us on Telegram and on Twitter, and please follow VJ and all the people on stage. Well, VJ, maybe it's interesting to talk a little bit about what we saw happening this year with all the FUD that was going on, like Elon Musk and the China ban on mining. How do you look at that? What's your opinion on that?
Elon Musk, I mean, he's an interesting character. He's one of the world's richest people. You know, people got excited because he said he was accepting payment, his company was accepting payment for the vehicles that they produce. I actually think that is that kind of announcement is more for show than substantive, because really people in general don't want to spend their bitcoins, because it's something that's becoming money, and in the process of becoming money, it's appreciating in purchasing power so rapidly that there's an opportunity cost to spending your Bitcoin. And I think people have sort of learned this over time. And there's a famous example of this guy who bought two pizzas. Pizza Day. We celebrate it now, but he bought two pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoin, which is now worth $350 million. So I think people have learned that, Bitcoin is not good for spending yet. I mean, eventually it will be when it's globally adopted, but until then, it's appreciating and purchasing power so much that it's not really good for spending. And so companies which say we're accepting Bitcoin, I think what they see, and if you look at the data, most of them don't get many purchases in Bitcoin. And another factor, at least in the United States, why you don't see many purchases is that when you spend your Bitcoin, if you use it to buy a car, you have to pay tax on that purchase on any appreciation that your Bitcoin has had. So people don't want to pay their taxes. They'd rather keep their gains into the future. I think that was more a marketing thing. And Elon Musk is pretty good at marketing. He's got like a very big presence on Twitter. I am pretty honestly very disappointed in he has so many followers. I think he was just incredibly irresponsible, like pumping up this Doge thing. Like Dogecoin was created as a joke, kind of as a parody by its creator. As look, it's easy to create one of these coins and they don't have any value. He was trying to parody the whole space. And it was a joke, and there's no way that this thing is going to ever be taken seriously in a large way. So for Elon Musk to pump it, he's getting people who don't know any better, and there are people who are very average investors who don't have much money who are reading his tweets and saying, oh, I should put some of my money in Dogecoin, and what will happen? I think what is happening is it's gonna collapse all the way back to near zero. I mean, that's what happened with Dogecoin. Had one big rally when it was created, because it was this funny meme, this dog that was kind of funny, the Shiba Inu dog, and it was kind of cute, and people were creating memes in 2013 about it, and then it crashed almost to zero. I think that's going to happen again. And what makes me really sad is that Musk has so many followers who think that he knows something about the world and about investing, that they followed him into Dogecoin, and they're going to lose their savings.
I was going to say he's just been a big kid probably. But what are the good arguments against, like, a lot of people prefer Cardano or XRP or Dogecoin above Bitcoin? What are like strong arguments against against other coins, actually, against the alts?
Yeah, so I think Bitcoin has by far the biggest network effect. And I think network effects are really important in any product or service where there's a network effect. It's the most important feature, because people want to use the thing that everyone else is using. And there's just and then the network effect encompasses a whole bunch of things. There's the brand effect. Like Bitcoin is always mentioned. Whenever an altcoin is mentioned, it's always in the context of Bitcoin. So the brand network effect is very strong. It has by far the best developers, the best cryptographers working on it. There's all this financial infrastructure that's built to support Bitcoin. So futures markets and lending markets and things like that. They all support Bitcoin. Most of these altcoins don't have anything like that. Most of the altcoins are also very, very illiquid, which means that they're easy to manipulate. If you put in a small amount of money into them, you can move the price a lot. So that, you can pump them up, but really it's hard to sustain that because they don't have enough liquidity. And when someone pumps them up and you get, noobs excited about it, you can dump on them, and that's what happens with these altcoins. The other thing I would say is that I think people misunderstand these monetary goods and think of them as technologies rather than as forms of money. And in terms of forms of money, they compete on monetary attributes. They don't compete on the technological bells and whistles. So they compete on things like scarcity and fungibility and divisibility. Attributes that make for a good money. So along those attributes, I don't see anything that is superior to Bitcoin. I think it has the best monetary attributes. And when something comes along that has a network effect, you really need to be orders of magnitude better to surpass it or to convince people to switch over to it. So it would be very easy for me to build something like a Facebook that looked like Facebook anyways, a small social network, but it has such a dominant network effect. There's no way I'm going to convince people to come over to VJBook to use my social network. So I think that Bitcoin has that dominant network effect, and it's at such a large scale now that it can't be surpassed. And I think that most of the value is going to accrue to Bitcoin. That's not to say that all of these altcoins are going to completely die. I just think the vast majority of the value is going to accrue to Bitcoin. And my experience, working in technology and looking at, Google and the search engine space and various other parts of the technology space, wherever there's been a network effect, there's been one dominant winner that takes the vast majority of the market share. So, when I started at Google, there was a ton of different search engines. I don't know if you remember any of them, like AltaVista and Excite and Ask Jeeves and things like that. But no one thinks about those anymore. Maybe some of them are still around. But as an investor, I think it pays when you see a space which has a network effect that you have most of your capital in the dominant player, because it's almost always the case that the dominant player takes most of the market capitalization.
Vijay, let's talk about your book a little, because you wrote a book. It's called The Bullish Case for Bitcoin. What do people get out of it if they read it?
So I significantly expanded on the article that I wrote. I wrote a long form article in 2017. And I thought, I didn't want to write a book for a while because I didn't think I could add anything to it. And then when 2020 came around, we had this global pandemic, and the central bank response to it was so crazy. At least in the US, they created so much money and printed so much money that I thought this was a context in which I should revisit the ideas in the article and expand on them. And there were a few things that I thought were really important that I hadn't covered in the article that I really needed to address. And one of them was the historical context in which Bitcoin came about. People, the cypherpunk community had been trying to invent digital money for over a decade before Bitcoin came around. And most of them actually had given up and thought this isn't possible. So I thought it was important to provide that historical context. Another thing I thought was really important was exploring the question of what Bitcoin is, because there was this really big debate in 2017 and a split in the network and the creation of this, these alternate fork currencies like Bitcoin Cash. And that really centered around the debate of like, what is Bitcoin? What should it be? Is it like a store of value, or is it like a payment system? Is it like a decentralized version of PayPal? And there were certain people in the Bitcoin community who really strongly believed that Bitcoin should be like this low fee payment system, kind of like PayPal, but you know, more decentralized. And I really, in 2017, I really strongly disagreed with that, and I got into a lot of debates with people like Eric Voorhees and Mike Belshi and people who were pushing this alternate vision of Bitcoin, and they tried to change Bitcoin. They tried to change the rules of Bitcoin so it would be more like what they wanted. And I think it was for me really important to explain why I think Bitcoin is the way it is and why it has to be the way it is and why it's not possible to change it. Why it was really hard. They thought they had all of the biggest miners on board, all of the biggest companies on board. And I viewed this as an attack on Bitcoin. They tried to change the consensus rules of Bitcoin and they failed, which is incredible, right? The most powerful companies in the space were unable to change Bitcoin even though they wanted to. And I actually viewed that as a very, very healthy and positive development because it shows that Bitcoin is not susceptible to attack, because that's the biggest threat ultimately to Bitcoin is nation states attacking it. And if it was possible that some companies could get together and change it for the way they like, then why is Bitcoin even interesting? It's not interesting at all. It's not decentralized. It's just a bunch of people come together and do whatever they want with it. The fact that it's immutable, that it can't be changed, is what makes it valuable and what makes it powerful. And also it's what makes us trust that this monetary policy, the 21 million hard cap on the supply, is actually real. If it could be changed, then we wouldn't believe it. So that was something that I really needed to be explored, and I write about that at length in my book. I also cover a lot more misconceptions about Bitcoin that I think, and risks about Bitcoin that I hadn't covered in the article. Things like the environmental impact of Bitcoin, and some other, you know, misconceptions that come up a lot, like, well, why would I buy one Bitcoin when it's $35,000 when I can buy one XRP, which is, you know, less than a penny or whatever it's worth? Absolutely. I cover things like that. I cover things that I hadn't covered in the book that I thought were important.
Okay, dude, I'm going to buy your book, man. I just can't wait. Just piggybacking on what you just said, I agree. I totally.
Can I ask you guys a question though? Should I do a Dutch version, or would you be happy?
Yes.
Do one. Sure.
Yeah, do it in Dutch,
of course.
Man.
Yes. If you can, Vijay.
I know you guys speak English, so you're all fluent in the Netherlands with English, so I was curious what you thought about that, whether it's worth getting a translation and whether you would prefer that.
Yep.
I would.
I think there is
a group of a few, I think, volunteers that recently translated the Bitcoin Standard from Saifedean and the Little Bitcoin Book, so might be interesting to see if these guys are up for that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to be connected with them. If you guys think it's something that's worthwhile, and that the people in the Netherlands would, you know, like to have a Dutch translation, then I'll definitely get it done.
Yeah, I will try to bring you in contact with them, Vijay. I will come back with it later, okay?
Thank you. I
Good
appreciate
stuff.
That.
Hey Vijay, so on the topic of those attacks on Bitcoin, right? So what are your views on the fungibility attack, which is going on right now on the ESG compliant green coin versus the coal coin? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, in my book, I do talk about this. I think we should always be open and honest about where we see weaknesses in Bitcoin. We shouldn't just be people who are pumpers who, you know, just pump it because we want the price to go up. I think fungibility is a weakness of Bitcoin because not at the network layer, right? Any Bitcoin can move on the network layer like any other Bitcoin. So it's fungible at that level. The problem is because the blockchain is open and transparent, governments can come along and say, hey, well, we don't like these bitcoins, and you're not businesses are not allowed to touch these bitcoins, and businesses can see, you know, where those bitcoins are moving, and so they, if they get a deposit, they'll just lock it down. That makes Bitcoin less fungible than cash, and I think that is a weakness that needs to be improved upon. I am optimistic that there will be developments in Bitcoin that will make this less of a problem. So, for instance, the recent protocol upgrade that's being locked in called Taproot will make improve Bitcoin's privacy to some extent, and I think mixing technologies will improve. And I think that the future is bright for privacy improvements for Bitcoin, but right now it is a weakness that there are certain Bitcoins that have been tainted in a way because governments have said, we don't want you to trade those Bitcoins. So for instance, there might be people in Iran who have Bitcoins and they're not allowed to trade them to exchanges. And I think that's a huge tragedy, right? Whatever you think of the Iranian government, whether it's good or bad, there are millions of people in Iran who are honest, hardworking people who want to keep their savings, and to completely cut them off and to say you're not allowed to trade the thing that you're keeping your savings in, I think is really an awful thing. So it is important that Bitcoin, at the protocol level, we get better privacy and improvements to the privacy. I'm excited that Taproot was locked in and approved, so that people will be able to do things like multi-signature in a way that makes it more private. So yeah. It is an area for improvement, but let's see in the next couple of years if it Bitcoin becomes more private and more fungible because of that.
Yeah, because the Kevin O'Leary standpoint of creating mining green coins, which they are asking a premium for, which was booed on in Miami on stage. I'm worried about that, to be honest.
Yeah, and you know, I think it may even become a marketing thing. I could see miners, you know, in the US, like they have these labels like grass-fed, organic, raised in a natural environment and humanely raised and all this. And some of them are just marketing. That's just a way to get people to pay more money. So it's funny. I kind of think that they may try this like humanely raised Bitcoin that's mined in, with renewable energy and stuff like that. So someone probably will profit from this. But ultimately, as Bitcoin becomes more fungible, it doesn't really matter because that people won't be able to tell the difference once it's traded a few times. Once it, you know, goes through a few hops, you won't be able to tell where it came from.
Vijay, you're in the Bitcoin in Netherlands room, and maybe it's interesting to do some technical analysis to see where we are with the price action. So we have two guys in the room, Anil and Patrick. They are our technical analyst specialist. Sorry, Anil, Patrick, can you give us an update?
Yeah, I think we can do a little TA. But I think it will be a short one because I think we're on a crossroads. There are two things where we're looking at the last few days. Anil and I were discussing it like 2 days ago about the Wyckoff accumulation. But there's also a possibility that we can look at a bear trap. And I think the most important thing right now is to hold certain levels around, like you want to break the 35K, hold that level and go further up to 38, 40, and afterwards you can gain up momentum and you can go up more aggressively
to the moon.
To the moon. Yeah, I'm still bullish, but I think it will take some time to gain that momentum. I think we're going to see some more consolidation and some levels have to be respected, and I really think we're on a crossroad of where we're going.
That's cool, man. Vijay, are you a trader or are you a hodler?
I'm a hodler. There are people who are much more talented than me, and I suspect Anil and Patrick are much more talented at this kind of thing. I don't know whether my mind is always open about whether we're, in this could be the start of a bear market. I don't know. Or it could be, maybe it's like 2013. Like 2013 had this mini bear market in the middle of the bull market where Bitcoin went up from like $30 up to $250. And then it crashed down to 50, and it kind of stayed around there for a while, and then it went all the way up to 1,000. So maybe it's like that. I do think it is, if you're doing technical analysis, I do think it can be kind of damaging psychologically when the market corrects by 50% or over 50%. Because typically in a bull market, you have corrections, when it's going parabolic. And those corrections, the market can handle corrections down to 30 or 40%, where people, they view it as an opportunity to buy the dip, to get in. But it can be, I think, just damaging when you get to 50%, because then people's psychology can shift to thinking, oh, instead of buying the dip, I'm going to sell the rip. So that's something that, I would be a little bit cautious about, but I'm not worried. Like I said before, if we are in a bear market, my view of my bullishness is over a long period of time, over the time span of a decade. And I feel much more excited about bear markets because they're such a great time to accumulate Bitcoin. And it's because everyone else has stopped paying attention. And it's also a great time for when the infrastructure is built, because that's when companies are really working on improving their infrastructure. And the financial infrastructure improved so much. Oh my goodness, so much from 2017 to now. Like the exchanges in the space were falling down, collapsing all the time in 2017. They couldn't handle the volume of traffic they were getting. They couldn't handle the trading. They're much, much better than they were. Even Coinbase, I have to give some credit. They used to go down all the time. They're at least a little bit better than they were. And that stuff happens. I think a lot of it happens during the bear market when people aren't paying attention and people aren't so distracted by the price. Like the price going up is really cool, right? We all feel excited. We feel like we're making more wealth, and that's really cool. But it's very distracting as well for people who are working at Bitcoin companies and they own Bitcoin. They start paying attention to that rather than putting their head down and working. So if we're in a bear market, so be it. I'm not concerned. If that's the case, I feel really excited to stack more sats and to accumulate when prices are low, because the people who do the best as investors with Bitcoin are those people who have the conviction during the bear market and they just continue to accumulate. The people who come in at the last minute in the bull market, those are the ones who generally don't do as well, and they usually panic sell and things like that. So, my hat is off to people who are good at trading. I'm not good at that. I don't have the right psychology for it. But I don't know. I don't know where we are. I kind of agree with Patrick that it does feel like a bit of a crossroads. We don't know which direction we're going to go. I hope we resume. That would be really cool if it was like 2013 and this ride isn't over, because it's always exciting to be in a bull market, and they're generally shorter compared to the bear market, so you don't get to enjoy them as long. But it would be cool if the bull market continued into the end of the year. I hope it does.
Yeah, maybe Anil have something, an opinion about the charts, because he always have this honest opinion about the charts.
Thank you, Patrick. And thank you for having you here, PJ. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for the back noise. I'm in the gym. Hopefully it's not disturbing.
I hope you're deadlifting.
Yeah, I took a pause for 5 minutes so I could speak. A little TA on a shorter time frame, really bullish. What I can see on the charts that we have the inverse head and shoulder, technically is very bullish with a breakout target to $36,000-$37,000. Also on the bigger time frame, yeah, we are stuck in a wedge, broadening bottom wedge, most likely to break up higher to higher prices. What I want to see is that we can reclaim the levels of $40,000 to $43,000 and consolidate a little bit there and go to the roof. Short term, I'm really bullish. Mid term, really bullish. Long term, always bullish. So, yeah, I'm also on HODL and trader. Really glad that I'm that I have some bitcoins. So the future is bright for us, for all of us.
That's it.
Always positive. That's what we like to hear. So I've opened up the hand. So if anyone has a question, then just raise your hands, and we'll get you on stage. If not, we will just continue our conversation. Vijay, do you see any risks for Bitcoin?
I think, you know, in the early days, I think the biggest risk for Bitcoin was protocol risk. We didn't know whether the protocol was actually was free of flaws or was as rock solid as we believe it to be now. And when Satoshi published the protocol in 2008, it was actually met with a lot of skepticism. The people on the cryptography mailing list thought that this wasn't even possible. So they thought, you know, when he posted, they said, this isn't going to work. But I think over the years, we've sort of recognized that the protocol is rock solid, and that risk has diminished dramatically. It's always going to be a tail risk that someone discovers something which is like a fundamental flaw or the cryptography is broken or something like that. But, you know, I think the biggest risk is still nation-state attack, and that's nation-states recognizing that Bitcoin is a threat to their monetary policy and trying to crack down on it. And I view this as really an issue of whether Bitcoin gets enough political capture before nations try to attack Bitcoin, especially in the democratic countries, whether it gets enough political capture. And an example I use a lot is the company Uber, the ride-sharing company. And they had this business model where they would launch their ride-sharing service in cities, and they wouldn't ask permission from the city government. They just start their service. And the taxi lobby, the incumbent taxi lobby, would often be really upset and say, well, this business is unregulated, they're out-competing us, they're beating us, and we're losing business. You need to crack down on this. And by the time the local city governments did anything, Uber would have enough of a base of employees, people who are earning money by driving, and a base of users who are really passionate about using ride-sharing. That was a natural constituency which defended Bitcoin. And I think the same thing is true. Defended Uber. And I think the same thing is true of Bitcoin, where as it grows in adoption, that creates this natural constituency of people who don't want Bitcoin to be attacked, who don't want regulations that are harmful to Bitcoin. And in the United States, we're already seeing people in Congress who are being elected who are pro-Bitcoin just because they have constituents who are pro-Bitcoin. And that's across the political spectrum, which is really fantastic. And a really important development is we have the first U.S. senator who's so pro-Bitcoin, she owns Bitcoin. And she has said that she wants to explain to her fellow senators why Bitcoin is important. And the U.S. senators have a lot of power. Individual senators have a lot of power. So I think that's a very important development. I don't think Bitcoin has enough political capture yet that it's invulnerable. But I do believe that over the next 5 years or so, it can get to that position. One of the things I think is encouraging is that governments are generally slow moving. They don't figure things out very quickly. And they only have a very slight inkling that Bitcoin is a threat right now.
Yep, super incompetent.
They're starting to recognize a little bit like, oh, if this becomes big, maybe it's a threat to our monetary policy. But it's so slow to act that I feel optimistic that Bitcoin will get enough adoption and have a strong enough constituency that shutting it down will become as difficult as trying to shut down, say, the internet. Like, you can imagine a government trying to shut down the internet in a democratic country. There's absolutely no way, because so many people's livelihoods and their businesses their income streams depend on having the internet running, that you just couldn't do it. And I view it as the kind of the same thing with Bitcoin. It's an open question, though. We could see nation-state attacks start earlier. I don't know, but this is something that I think is the biggest risk. But it's something that I'm also fairly optimistic about.
Okay, thank you, Vijay. I saw someone raising their hand, but they left. You told at the beginning of our conversation that you also would like to learn a bit about the Dutch Bitcoin community.
I would love to hear what's going on in the Netherlands for sure.
Yeah, our friend Roy, he works for an investigation company, and they wrote a report about that. So maybe he can give some insights on that, Roy.
Please, I would love to hear that.
Yeah, he's working for a research company, so he actually does.
Yeah, he might be also in the gym with Anil, maybe. Looks like he's not able to.
Maybe he's spotting Anil. Like they're benching now.
Oh, yeah. Good one.
Yeah, he's not real right now. He can't speak. But the conclusions were that I think 7 to 10% of the Netherlands knows about Bitcoin and basically is pretty interested in it. That's how I perceived it. But I didn't get all the answers from his research because it's actually a paid research. So he gets paid by some companies for these research results.
What are the exchanges like in the Netherlands? Do you guys acquire Bitcoin through sort of a European exchange, or do you have like a local Dutch exchange, or how does that
man,
work?
What a drama here. Okay, so we have local exchanges here, not at the level of Coinbase and Kraken and all of that, but we do have local exchanges, but the Central Bank of the Netherlands, they try to destroy the space in the Netherlands. So what they did was they made a ruling in which all the companies were compulsory to get screenshots of all the addresses if you are taking out your Bitcoins from that exchange. If you're transferring that to your cold wallet, you would need to provide the exchange with a screenshot and then maybe your face. And in some cases, they wanted to record your laptop, so they really wanted to see what browser you're using and if that is you or not. In some cases, we have also seen that they requested 3D video of your face, like from year to year. And
there was a court case, and it got rejected by the judge now. But yeah, there's some troubles because Holland is quite pioneering with certain with Bitcoin in the beginning, but now with all the regulatory drama, as Kant calls it, it's a bit more tough for the company, so they're leaving to Panama and all the other places.
Yeah, so the most exciting part of that was that this one exchange, they just fought the Central Bank of Netherlands in the court. And they got to remove all of those compulsory wallet verification methods, which is really cool and exciting.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds similar to what they're trying to do in the US, where they're trying to collect a lot of information from exchanges about people moving their Bitcoins. And they're really trying to attack the privacy aspect of Bitcoin and make it so everything is traceable and they know who has what, which is, I find a little bit scary. I think financial privacy is generally an important thing. That's really interesting. Do you guys have something, like in the US, we have a couple of businesses, one of them's called Swan and there's another one called River, which allow people to just dollar cost average, you know, just take a part of your paycheck, every paycheck, and instantly get it withdrawn and put into Bitcoin, and then it gets sent to your cold storage without you having to do anything. Do you have any services like that?
Yeah, we do. We have a few.
The one we that has that had the court case, Bitonic actually has a new dollar cost averaging thing for you. So yeah, we sort of have the same structure.
Yeah, we have a few. We also have Bitter as well, which is really loved in the Netherlands. So yeah, we do have one of those, a few of those.
Yeah, and if you're talking about the Dutch Bitcoin community, we do have someone that wrote a model to predict, to kind of predict, to see where Bitcoin is going. Maybe it's interesting for you.
Plan B.
Yeah, Plan B, and it's called the stock to flow model. So maybe it's interesting for you to have a look at that.
Yeah, I am. You know, I'm very familiar with Plan B and stock to flow. I'm generally cautious about models which predict or with high certainty the future. But I think it's incredibly interesting that it has been so accurate. I think the one thing that I really strongly agree with Plan B and Safer Dean, who's written about stock to flow as well, is that these hype cycles that Bitcoin goes through, I think they're very strongly connected, causally connected and triggered by the halving events. I think that is really what drives Bitcoin's price movements, the most important factor. Because what happens is Bitcoin goes through this cycle and it goes up into a parabolic move and then it crashes and it finds a plateau, and it finds a price plateau where people are willing to, you know, buy up and support the coins that have to be sold by the miners, because miners are marginal producers. They have to sell the bitcoins that they're producing to pay for the electricity costs. So they're forced, and the price finds a plateau where people are willing to buy what the miners have to sell, and then eventually you get a halving event. And the supply shock reduces the selling power of the miners. And so the demand that you have, which is supporting the price, is now excess over the supply. And I think that really is what triggers these bull markets. So that's something I think that is really, you know, accounted for in Plan B's stock to flow. And that's the part that I really strongly agree with. How accurate is going to be into the future? I hope he's accurate. I mean, I think it's so amazing how accurate it has been so far. We're going to see right now, it looks like the price is kind of at the lower band of his stock to flow. We'll see if it sort of picks up and gets back into to where his model predicts. It would be really cool if it does. I've said that, you know, I wrote on Twitter, if this continues to be accurate, even just for a few more years, I think he should be awarded a Nobel Prize.
Yes,
it's absolutely insane that he's able to predict these movements so far ahead.
Together with
it's
Satoshi.
Pretty cool. You guys have some. You guys have some famous Bitcoiners produced from the Netherlands. Plan B and Tour de Meester is Dutch as well, I believe.
Yes, yes, yeah. I mean, it's the food, man. It's in.
Yeah, I was wondering what it is for a country that's not so big. How do you produce so many great Bitcoiners?
Yeah, I mean, the beginnings of central banking was also in the Netherlands, right?
Yeah, you guys invented it.
Just pioneers overall, but I mean, it's a bit of a shame that the regulatory system is a little bit working against it. But it's good on the other hand that the judge tapped their fingers and, you know, they got put back in the corner. So that's good.
Do you guys feel like the Dutch regulatory system is better or worse than, you know, neighboring countries or countries in Europe? How does it compare?
I feel like it's all the same, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's mainly Europe that decides that.
Yeah, we have the centralization of power in Europe, which is. I mean, Switzerland is a heaven for that, right? For regulations around Bitcoin. So, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is, in an international context, the Netherlands gets pretty much criticized for being a tax haven. And what they do is with these anti-money laundering regulations or directives that come from the Financial Action Task Force, is that the way they translate it into national legislation is even more strict than of some of the other European countries. So to somehow counteract this criticism, and exactly. the entire Bitcoin sector is the victim of that.
Well, VJ, we're almost speaking for 90 minutes now, so I think it's time to go and end this room. Will you come back again, around the end of the year to see where we are?
I would love to. I'd love to hear developments in
and
your
then
country.
Maybe you can send us your translated version of your book by then.
I would love to. If you guys can connect me with some people who will help me with translation, I'd love to get a Dutch translation.
Sure, we'll do that. We'll check it ourselves. Just come by the Telegram group and we'll do that.
Thank you.
Roy said he will connect you, so I'm sure that's going to be all fine.
Yes, for sure. I will help you out, Vijay. I will bring you in contact with them.
Thank you, guys. I had a translation into Dutch done for the article. So if you want to find the Dutch version of my article, which the book is based on, there is one. If someone could help me with the book, I'd really, really appreciate it.
Hey, Vijay, just before we end this room, let me just ask you a last question, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
So the question is, so you described the different phases of money which commodity goes through, right? So the collectible, the store of value, medium of exchange, and then unit of account. At what point can we say that Bitcoin has achieved the store of value phase, according to you?
I think that's a good question. I don't describe Bitcoin as a store of value right now. I describe it as a nascent store of value. It's something becoming a store of value. I think people, when they look at gold, they're totally fine calling it a store of value. I mean, gold still has volatility, right? It's not like gold is perfectly flat in purchasing power. It did in 2011, it dropped 30%, but people still recognize that gold has held its value over a long time. I think there'll be widespread recognition that Bitcoin is a legitimate non-store of value when it achieves the market capitalization of gold. And that's probably 20x from here. The price would have to be somewhere in the order of 500,000. If Bitcoin gets to about that level, about 500,000, I think people will say, "Yeah, this is like gold. This is a store of value. It's as big as gold." So we should think about it in the same terms.
Okay, cool. Thanks, man.
This was really great, man. We would like to thank you for your time and everyone in the audience. Let's stay in touch, Vijay, and let's do this again at the end of the year.
Yeah, it was great, Vijay. Thanks so much.
We would like to wish you the best with
thanks,
your book.
Thanks, guys.
And everyone in the
audience. I'll be supporting the Netherlands in the UEFA Cup, so go the Netherlands.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for your time, Vijay.
Bye, guys.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Love you, Vijay.
Bye-bye.
Good morning.